Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Typical, disgusting display.
Tonight, we got them. Goldie and the Salt.
And it starts right now.
We built this, Goldie.
Nothing more beloved than alarms.
Who doesn't love?
First joke of the day. First joke of the day.
Got it early. That was a good one. That's true. Did Stu think of that? People hate alarms, but I'm going to write about them anyway.
I'm going to give you jury duty.
Here comes your dentist appointment.
Your wife wants to talk.
I think we got something to work with there. We can go into the stew. Yes. Dio.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, I mean, I just unveil it now. I was going to hold it till later, but I made a special surprise for you, and JC has it.
Yes.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
You want to play it?
Yes. Here we go.
Here we go. 3, 2, 1.
We built this, Alec. We built this, Alec, by smoking weed. Built this, Alec. We built this, Alec, by smoking weed.
Spent all week on this.
Got it.
So now we're even.
I love it. By the way, this is how you react to something like that. Goldie, thank
that
you.
Awesome.
Oh, that is so sweet.
Put a lot of thought into it.
A lot of love.
And just JC and I were in constant contact throughout the week.
The production was very intense.
His roommate brought the bonga.
Oh, that's good. That's more accurate. That's more accurate, I think, than our song. Our song, our podcast did not build me, but it's possible that we built me. We can all agree on that. Well, welcome back to another episode of A Typical Disgusting Display, a podcast for writers by writers who hate writing. And I just want to start this week by saying we got a bunch of great emails from you guys this week.
Yeah.
And we'll get to them, you know, when we're desperate some week. But there were a lot of very funny ones. So I want to encourage you to keep writing in to us at atypicaldisgustingdisplay@gmail.com with any questions, comments, and take note that we are now within a month of Goldie's 50th birthday. So if you want to send him a birthday wish, send it to atypicaldisgustingdisplay@gmail.com. If you could see his face right now, he is so excited.
I want to send you an email verbally right now.
Yes.
Dear Atypical Disgusting Display, I FaceTimed my podcast partner this morning prior to our podcast simply to go over what we might talk about, review ideas, make sure we were on the same page to try to ensure a seamless presentation to our listeners. When my podcast partner, Alex Sulkin, picked up, He was taking a shit, and he still picked up anyway.
I did.
What am I supposed to do in this situation, question mark?
Hang up.
Is it appropriate to pick up a FaceTime while you are taking a shit?
Well, here's the answer to that. The short answer is so no. But the longer answer is that I know my own ass. And I knew at that point when you called, nothing was happening. There was the third base coach was holding all traffic.
Oh, was there anything in the bowl already?
Nothing okay, in the bowl. Nothing in the bowl. And so also, you're not going to see my naked legs. I tilt
know,
it up.
That's simply the fact. Yeah. That there's bare butthole on seat.
Knowing
makes
that
me
it's there.
Extremely uncomfortable. Am I crazy?
Know,
JC,
you're
impartial. Hey, if JC, if he
oh,
picked,
I
up...
picked up. I wouldn't have picked up for JC. Oh, are you God. Kidding me?
That
I would have
weird.
Rushed to put my curlers on.
So it's a gender thing? I mean, JC,
yes.
Am I crazy
or,
here?
Yes, it's a gender thing.
You're definitely not crazy. But I also, is it a gender thing or is it how close you guys are?
Well, that's true, too.
I want to be further away.
Hold me closer, tiny dancer.
No, stay away from me, giant pimper. Dancer.
But I will say that I had just gotten off a FaceTime with Tal, who, you know, she's
okay with that?
Well, close. She is because she understands that there's going to be a 45-minute
wait.
Piece of the morning.
God, no wonder she won't pull the trigger on this marriage.
She might pull the trigger right next to my forehead at some point.
Geez, dark.
You're not helping yourself with this FaceTime shitting. I'll just tell you that. No one's walking away with a better impression of you than they had.
He's FaceTime shitting. Yes, that was a fun start to the morning, only because I saw how uncomfortable it made you, and what else is life about but making your close friends very uncomfortable and upset.
Oh, well, you did it.
Yeah, I did it. Something else we wanted to talk about quickly this morning was a couple of weeks ago, we watched and talked about the pilot of Friends and kind of in a nutshell, our takeaway was that while the casting is incredible and undeniably it went on to become one of the most successful sitcoms of all time, we didn't love the pilot.
It wasn't up to our standards.
It was not up to the Cheers pilot, the British Office pilot, other pilots that we've watched. So, and we talked about why we thought that was. So, of course, we put that out there on the airwaves, you know, blissfully ignorant of the impact that might have. And we start getting messages from Max Pross, who you might remember as half of the legendary writing team, Gamble and Pross. And Max wrote us a text that said, like, I wonder what Marta Kaufman, who's one of the creators and writers of the Friends pilot, would think about the Dad's pilot. And so, of course, that made Goldie and I both stop in our tracks and instantly realize that we are going to break down the Dad's pilot.
Oh, that's a great idea.
On an episode very soon, within the next couple of weeks.
I don't have the guts to invite Marta Kaufman, but that would be great.
Oh, God. Yeah, just have her watch it. And, of course, I'm sure the tragic thing was she'd be like, yeah, it was good. And we'd feel like even worse.
No.
Yeah, Goldie's saying no she wouldn't. No chance. So we're hyping this now. We're teasing it that within the next couple of weeks, we're going to be forced to rewatch the Dad's pilot, and we are going to come on here and eat crow, take our medicine, and just to show we are firm but fair. It's not.
And
like
also, you wrote it. You produced it. Here,
no,
I'm not sure where this we is coming from.
You know, I remember Goldie had some strong costume suggestions.
The guy came in for 3 hours one afternoon to offer a few simple suggestions, which you didn't take.
Well, Goldie, I will agree with that. The Friends pilot was written primarily by me and my then writing partner, Wellesley Wilde.
Not Friends.
But everything,
Dad's pilot.
Everything. At, what did I say?
Friends.
You said the Friends.
Oh,
pilot.
Yeah. Boy, I wish. I thought the checks might start coming my way. Yeah, no, the Dad's pilot. And then, so Goldie, you're right. You were not heavily involved with that pilot. But then I will say, every episode after the pilot, you wrote more of than anyone else on Earth. So you have written more Dads than anyone on this planet. And I think you need to have
and
a t-shirt.
I've never recovered from that. Then all of America will know what it's like to watch you take a shit.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Very second joke of the day.
We didn't get him to say that.
Yes, that's a very good.
The show that could only be described as a FaceTime on a toilet. Dance.
That's coming up. That medicine and more. That Goldie will share none of the blame, but get to chime in with these cracks.
Can't wait.
Yeah. But now let's get into a different kind of medicine. Let's get into Johnny jokes.
Oh, I almost forgot that this is my part, but live from Hollywood, here's Johnny's.
I'm nervous about one of my jokes, so I'm just staring at it.
Okay, good. Well, I have zero feeling for any of mine, if that helps you. Okay. Here we go. Here we go.
All right.
Start out with a quick one with a new kind of style here. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says she's not seeing any signs of recession in the U.S. economy. She then put on her glasses and went, yeah.
I thought you were going to do something with Janet Yellen.
I know. Why is Janet Yellen? I always tried to work in a joke about Jocelyn Elders, but couldn't quite get it.
I feel like it would, if we wrote for the show, you could make a trope about Janet Yellen, you know, and Janet's yelling again.
Yeah, here's it. And it's time, Janet Yellen time. Okay, and here's a topic Goldie and I texted about a little bit this week, but I'm doing a joke anyway. Well, the midterms are almost upon us, and Democrats are cautiously optimistic that they will maintain control of the House. Speaker Pelosi shared the news with her husband, and he promptly went home and got hammered.
Ah.
Terrible. Awful.
I passed on the joke, and he said it was... He said it was one of the best nights he'd had at home in a while.
The point is, everybody's laughing at this man.
As long as he's eventually going to be fine, then we don't look bad, right?
You bounce right. You bounce back from that stuff.
Yeah, when you're 80.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, moving on. The NFL held another game in London last weekend in hopes that American football will become more popular in Europe. One league official said if the plan goes well, they hope to score several Dutch towns. Dutch towns.
Only you.
Hey, everybody.
Only you. All right, and here's a closer that it's in no way a closer. Scientists have spotted, you notice I love to say scientists.
Science.
Scientists have spotted a planet killer asteroid that was apparently hiding in the sun's glare. Yeah.
Uh-oh.
The asteroid was even trickier to spot because it was whistling with its hands in its pockets.
Trying to act casual. Today's topsy-turvy time.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, we don't need anything confrontational.
Second, John.
All right, here we go. Well, an 8-year-old boy became the youngest person ever to climb the rock formation El Capitan. And when he got to the top, he said, "Mom, get me down."
That's nice. That's okay. A sweet one.
Little sweet joke. Okay, well, Elon Musk has taken control of social media giant Twitter. Yeah, insiders say he's already starting to put his signature stamp on the company, and he begun by getting 2 co-workers pregnant.
Ooh.
It's just sort of what he does. Yeah, all right. Speculation is rampant that Donald Trump will run for president again. And reportedly, he's already landed on a punchy slogan: "Make America as good as it was between 6 years ago and 2 years ago, and not now, but also kind of like it maybe was in the 50s until Elvis."
I like that one.
All right. This next one we may have to cut.
Okay.
I love it.
Depending on JC's reaction.
Okay.
New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft is sponsoring a Stand Up to Jewish Hate initiative, trying to unite different ethnic groups against anti-Semitism. Yeah, but things got pretty awkward when he asked Asians to lend a hand.
No, I like it.
That's a great line.
Come on.
Will I stop there? No, I will make you not like me, as the great Brody Stevens would have said.
Yeah. I hate you first.
Here we go. Well, the climate protest group that has been defacing famous paintings with food, says they have more attacks planned. Yeah. Ooh. They're going to throw a tamale at a dolly, fricassee a Monet, and smash Captain Crunch on a munch.
That's so good. Come on. That's sweet.
Yeah. That was great.
We built this, Alec.
On weed and coke. A cola.
Very edgy.
Some actual coke, but very little compared to the weed.
Well, you've got that manic energy.
Don't I? I could go all day.
He got coked up and he rose from his couch, walked to the fridge, and went back to the couch. He was nuts.
It's so uncomfortable.
Now, Goldie, I don't know why I'm still Johnny.
Goldie, I noticed, you've done this the past couple of weeks. You're breaking the social contract. You've done more than four jokes. But here's the thing I'll say. Why aren't you being a good squirrel and stockpiling those for a potential eight-joke run if you lose the NFL thing,
Because you know me, my need for approval is so great and my self-esteem is so low that I think the only solution is to throw quantity at it and then people will love me. Like, this next one will make you love me.
Right?
Of course, I'm wrong, but I can't stop. So it's compulsion.
That last one did make us love you. All those... wordplay with the artist, that was very good.
I mean, is this a good segue into maybe your football picks now?
Yeah. Let's do them now. So for those of you who are highly entertained by our football picks, we have more right now. We, Goldie and I, to recap, are tied. We're unsure if we're 3-3, 4-4, but we are tied.
I honestly think we're each like 4-1 and we're doing very well on the
That's
actual
not true.
Picks. Like I feel like I've only lost one, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, you've lost
but
two.
But every week I feel like, well, we both won.
Okay. Well, last week, that's true. We did both win. So whatever we are, we're tied. That's the important number is that we're tied because the loser has to do an eight joke Johnny monologue while the other one gets to sit back and relax like Ferris Bueller. So that's the highest stakes. So this week, Goldie, we got our picks. Who do you have this week?
Okay. You know, hate the board as always. Hate my pick as always. But I am going to take the Green Bay Packers, who are getting 3.5 points against the Detroit Lions in Detroit. I think the Packers have to turn it around this week. I think Detroit's defense is terrible. So I just predict they're going to win by 4 points or more. They have to. They have to.
Okay.
I love the pick. The pack. Pack pick. All right. So I'm going to stay with you in the NFC North, my friend. I'm picking the Minnesota Vikings.
Ugh.
who are giving 3.5 against the Washington Commanders. And the Commanders right now are a dumpster fire, you know, so I think Minnesota's kind of been cruising, and hopefully they'll win. So those are our two picks.
Well, worst of luck to you, my friend.
Thank you too, my friend. All right.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Oh, boy. Boy, we are incredibly excited for this portion of the podcast today because we have a talented, respected, and successful writer here, which is a vast difference from what we usually have with me and Goldie. We have Mr. Dan Levy here. Dan has been on the Goldbergs for almost a decade. He just completed... What, are you already shaking your head?
He hasn't been on the Goldbergs for a while.
You've been off the Goldbergs for a while?
Yeah, I've been off the Goldbergs for a while.
What are you doing here? Awesome. I emailed you this stuff.
You said he was on the Goldbergs since 2013.
No, I didn't.
I started in 2013, then I left in 2019.
Awesome. 2019, up until very recently, was on the Goldbergs.
Yes.
Do you want to start over? Should I keep
let
it?
Let me start it okay. over.
I get Goldie. I texted you, stand up, just finished opening for Mulaney on a 100 City tour.
I know that. Yeah.
Is that true?
I was getting to that.
I think I was we getting keep to this that.
This is awesome.
So okay, yeah, keep it going.
Had overall at Sony the same time as
nobody
me.
Cares about that, about your timeline. We're talking to guests.
Third bullet point, sold a ton of shows. Good area to get his advice.
I understand.
Fourth area, NBC sitcom with Fran Drescher.
Yeah, seemed like a weird
fifth
thing to
area,
point out.
Has upcoming show with Kevin Hart about sneakerheads.
Yeah, I'm getting
don't
to all that.
Don't see Goldbergs in there, pal.
Where do you say he left the Goldbergs in 2019?
I didn't even say he went to the Goldbergs. So why would I say he left somewhere that I didn't say he
as
was?
As Alec pointed off air, I worked in the Goldbergs, and this is George Siegel's sweater. So that
that's
important
George
for
Siegel's
everyone
sweater
to know.
He's wearing today. He got it in the will. And also, I will point out, which we had talked about before you got on, Goldie, which is you texted me all this stuff last night, and I responded, and while I was responding I knew it was going to piss you off for some reason. Mm-hmm. So I text you, I'm like, actually I know Dan, I've had a couple lunches with him and he's been to the Cape. There's a long pause and then I get the thumbs down emphasis on the text. Why does that piss you off? Express yourself.
Well,
why?
When was this lunch? When he was on the Goldbergs in 2014?
Yes. It was quite a while ago. It was pre-COVID. I'm sorry. You having a lot of lunches with Dan?
Dan, who do you think knows more about you, Dan? Me or Alan?
I think you. But, but I will say that even if I joined the Goldbergs in 2013, it still wouldn't have been a decade because I joined the show season 3. The show just is now season 10. So we
I said almost a decade.
Almost
a decade. I was trying to pump you up, for God's sake.
No, hey, I like it. Say it. It's fine.
All right. So there was a lot more to the intro, which I'm now too afraid.
It's the
afraid.
Only sitcom that's still on TV, so
that's
I'm happy
right.
to pretend I
that's right.
there.
I know. Yeah. We'll get to that.
Shout
Believe
out to Lou
me.
Schneider.
Okay.
So,
and
yes.
Lou Schneider. Shout out to Lou Schneider.
Lou Schneider. Lou. Along came a Schneider. So you just finished 100 date stand-up tour with Mulaney. Doesn't matter who was headlining. You guys were both out there.
It's more about me. That tour is more about me.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I know we went through some personal stuff, but it's really that tour is about me and my jokes.
So now you've been talking for 3 minutes now amidst the intro here, but welcome, Dan, and thank you for being here. And Dan, we know you're made of time today. Lots of time. We're just going
to
get
clear
into
that
it.
Up. Yeah. I just wanted to know, because I never did a podcast at 7 in the morning, so I was trying to gauge exactly when.
You've got stuff to do.
I got stuff to do in at least 4 hours, so I'm trying to figure out, is it going to be a Joe Rogan situation? Are we talking for 6 hours?
Oh, Goldie does a good Rogan. Goldie, give him a Rogan question. There it is.
So, the Goldbergs. This was something that was based on Adam Goldberg, but you were there too?
That's a great Rogan.
It's just like the pace is just excruciating, and then he's puzzled by everything a little bit, and everything's an X-Files style investigation.
Always.
Into something that's not really a mystery.
There is some conspiracy stuff behind the Goldberg, though.
Ooh,
what?
No, I'm just oh,
how would you know? You haven't been there in forever. So Dan Levy, made of time.
That's me. So much time.
Easier,
all I have is time.
Easier to get a chunk of Steve Levitan's time than Dan Levy's. But we are all here together. Okay, so my first question, which is already out of the box, was that Goldie was annoyed that you and I knew each other. And we got to that. It bothered him immensely, gave me the thumbs down.
Mm-hmm.
But
well,
so
not that you knew each other, but that you were so
how
you kind of
you were putting this into it.
I think you probably debated whether like should I jump him with this on air?
Oh, never. I did not, which is why I texted you. Boy, you tar me with the worst brush, I tell you. And you're putting all this stuff on it from your mind. You're like, oh, it's a text. They're words.
Yeah. Hey guys, you guys can both be friends with me. It's fine.
I know. This is like a fourth grade love triangle here. All right. So, Dan,
yes.
Getting back to you and away from Goldie, please. Who's now leaving the podcast for some reason. He's going away. Very respectful. So you were, I read this and I didn't know this because I don't know you that well. You were born and raised in Stamford, Connecticut. Is that right? So
Stamford, Connecticut. Right.
So home of Purdue Pharma. Were the streets paved with opiates when you were growing up? Just an idyllic.
There was Vicodin everywhere. There's Vicodin everywhere. It's also where WWE, formerly WWF, has their headquarters.
That's right.
So when I was in high school, the only people who spoke to us and gave us life advice were wrestlers just roided out on steroids.
Wait, is that true?
Swear to God. They'd come in. We'd have like, you know, don't do drugs. And they would be like shooting up their steroids in the bathroom and be like, don't do drugs. Work out. It's going to be great. And we're like, what the fuck is this?
Who'd you get? Like, who would come?
No. And it was like, C-level tag team guys would come in with like Speedos and they'd like sit like on the corner of the stage. And
be like, Brian Blair jumping Jim Brunzel.
Are those real people going?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
awesome.
Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo. I watched a lot of wrestling in like the early 80s.
One time we were supposed to have Undertaker and then he bailed. So then it was just like some second tier.
Understudy.
Understudy came in.
That's when you get Leaping Lenny Poffo, a.k.a. the genius.
Yes.
I love that you know all these people.
I'm very impressed.
And did you ever get a Sackler brother in there to speak to you guys?
No, that would have been nice.
They might have had some real advice.
At least some business advice.
Yes. They seemed to know what they were doing. But the overall question there is because that's something that we have in common. Jewish boys growing up in a sort of well-to-do area. So where does the comedy first come from for you? Did you have funny parents growing up?
My parents were funny. I just remember just being obsessed with comedy at a very young age. I remember being 9 years old and watching Aiden Even the Improv and just being like obsessed with stand-up. And that's kind of how it all started. I was like just like reading books, watching specials, and just got obsessed. And then it kind of like just went into like watching all these sitcoms, and then I was like so into In Living Color and then SNL, and just kind of like, you know, went from there. My dad used to listen to David Letterman every single night. So I used to go to bed to my dad laughing at the top 10 list like every single night.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So I just have always loved comedy.
And you say you got sort of obsessed with stand-up at a young age. Do you remember any of the stand-ups with whom you were obsessed as a kid?
I don't remember the comedian's name, but I remember the first joke that I thought was funny, he was doing, the whole premise was that the theme song to the circus, which is like dun 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 dun, came from like, you know, back in the day when there was like, you know, giant Greek warriors like fighting in Colosseums. And he's like, could you imagine what that would have been like? Like this Greek welcome to the Greek Colosseum. This guy's coming out. They're going to kill each other. I don't know who that comic is, but that joke is like in my brain forever. And I was like, this is so funny.
That's amazing.
I give that guy credit for my life.
Whatever his name is.
Whoever.
So if you're out there, contact me. I'll give you all my Goldberg's money from season 6 to season 10.
It was longer than that. We know that. And look at, by the way, I'm looking at my next question, which is hilarious in that context. It just says, Goldberg's there from the start? ? My good buddy, Dan Levy.
Talk about at this lunch? What are you not doing?
Well, your buddy Steve Bazalone was there, so it was hard for you to get a word in edgewise.
Steve Bazalone is very jealous of him on this podcast. He's very jealous.
Yeah, he listens, and I appreciate that.
Oh, that's so cool.
Steve Bazalone, by the way, very talented writer, very funny guy. Was it his grandfather or great-grandfather is one of the greatest war heroes in American history.
His great-grandfather was one of the greatest war heroes of all time, and Steve is a soft writer.
Yes, very soft.
Very emotional.
Goldie, his grandfather was this guy, John Bazalone, who was like the hero of World War II in the Pacific Theater.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So
Steve posted the other day that he was crying on Instagram. So they're very similar. They have the DNA runs.
Yeah, no. Steve dressed up as the "You Can Call Me Al" video. So he's doing his part. He's a hero of sorts.
He's an American hero.
No, Steve, we love you, and we'd love to have you on this podcast at some point.
He wrote for Community. You know, that's my favorite. I love that show.
Oh, look at you Googling on the fly.
Goldie taught me I could do that while we're on air.
Yeah.
You could just like look at the internet the whole time we're on
zone
air.
Zone out.
Not
zone
even
out.
Listen. It's possible.
I think Goldie
just
does
check
that
your
when
email.
I talk.
Oh, just look at the stock market and if it hits a certain point, determine that you can leave because you have enough money. Yeah, you could do that.
But Dan, to talk about the Goldbergs for a little bit, because you were there for a while. Now, what was that experience like? I mean, obviously, I just learned you came in on season 3, so it was a going concern. But it's rare in Hollywood to be on a show that gets picked up year after year after year. So what was that experience like for you?
For me, it was awesome because I was only on shows that were canceled sort of immediately, you know? Right. So this was the first time I was inside. Joining season 3, the show was already a hit, you know? So it was like entering a hit TV show, which was so different. You know, there was like incredible lunches. There was 24 episodes. And just to kind of like watch at the time, Adam sort of like make the whole show. And it was he was all in on it. And that was sort of like a really cool experience for me because just watching like just all he cared about, you know, it was just everything was just like perfecting the stories and making it as true to like his family as possible. Right. And that was when I kind of got the idea to do a show based on my family, you know, just kind of watching how real everything was for him into the show. And I was like, my parents are insane. I could do a show. And then I tried and then it was canceled, but at least I tried.
You did try. Yeah,
that's something you have in common with the other podcasters on this show. So I wanted to talk about this too, because I was looking through your IMDb and I saw that you wrote for Whitney, her show, and you wrote for Mulaney, his show. So those were famously like unsuccessful shows. Let's just say it like that.
Yes.
And having been the creator of one of the most famously unsuccessful shows of all
maybe
time, dads,
maybe,
you know, we're fighting, but they're in the conversation. So what do you think happened? Because Mulaney and Whitney are both incredibly funny people. Like they're both hilariously smart, funny, sharp. So what happens there, do you think, between them being hilarious and then this show coming out that's just, it's not really doing it? Like,
it's funny because they're both so funny and so smart and like great producers. So they put together these incredible writers' rooms.
Yes.
So like on those shows, I was having the best time of my life. Like, you're just like, this is it. Yeah. We're going to get really rich now. And everything's going to be perfect. We're laughing so much. We're having the best time. And then the show comes out. You're like, wait, what? What just happened? Like, the Mulaney table reads, like, I'm not exaggerating. It was like applause breaks. You know, it was like Martin Short, John. People were going insane, like crying, laughing, sweating. Yeah. And then we made, I think the problem with some of the times is that when you're making these shows, we're kind of in a bubble, you know? And, you know, that kind of happened with my show, too, where it's like you're making the show, it's not airing. Where it used to be you'd make the show, it's coming out, and then you're sort of like reading the reviews or seeing how things are working or finding out what actors are better and what they're best at, and you're sort of like rewriting stuff based on that information, but you're not getting any information.
Right.
So everything, you're in this sort of bubble where you think everything is so funny because you're doing it, you know?
Yeah.
And then it comes out, and then you're like, fuck, I wish that we had like the right reaction, you know, while we are in the process of making it. And I think that was part of it. I also think like, you know, everyone, they were, you know, I feel like John and Whitney both were like very young at the time and didn't have like tons of, you know, sitcom experience, you know, and exactly how to like manage that. And I also think like when you're on the show, you know, you guys know when you're running a show, your life is insane and you die. So if you do that and you're actually on camera, so it's impossible. Like Whitney, you know, ate powdered peanut butter and ended up weighing one pound, you know? And like, John had like crazy skin stress constantly. Like it's a really hard schedule.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, to wrap your head around that, you don't realize that until you're in it and you're like have to rewriting episode to 4 a.m. and then you have to be on stage to rehearse at 8 a.m. you know?
Mm. Yeah.
So
let me ask, like, on particularly Mulaney, I remember I wasn't at NBC ever really, but Mulaney, I remember the executives were super cocky about before it ever aired. Like the executives were telling us, and a little bit was a little bit of shaming of dad's isn't like Mulaney. Like they were kind of like using it as a little bit of a stick to whap us on the nose for our lack of performance.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, when was the first indication for you that this was not going to go as everyone thought?
Well, it was an NBC pilot, and it was a different sort of show. It was like him having, like, the original, I think, pilot script was called, like, Mulaney Don't Drink, and it was about him sort of getting sober, and then it was going to start this, like, life with his two roommates. But then the show didn't get picked up at NBC, and Kevin Reilly went to Fox and was like, I love John Mulaney, let's do 6 episodes. And then we just did 6 episodes for Fox. So we never even did a pilot to get any sort of like reaction, you know, from, you know, anyone. And we just made 6 episodes. I think they even like picked up maybe like a back 7 or something. We did a few, we did a bunch of episodes, but then we didn't know until it started airing immediately. Once the reviews came out, it was that's how we realized it wasn't going to work.
Yeah. Well, but Fox and Mulaney is not a match. I mean, I can't believe that NBC, after all Mulaney had done, frankly, to help SNL stay incredibly relevant, you know, with his sharp writing and update stuff. I can't believe that NBC did not give that show a chance, because I think that's one of those shows that the only chance it probably had was to be on NBC.
Well, in their defense, they had Animal Hospital.
That's right. I remember that show.
Yeah. Well, it's just so insane how everything just constantly changes. Where, like, during that time, it was a lot of like NBC was like Parks and Rec. The Office had just ended. It was like Brooklyn Nine-Nine was gaining. That was at Fox. But you know what I mean? It was like, it was those kind of shows were happening. And then, and now it's like you call NBC, they're like, only bring us multicams, you know? So it's like,
it's impossible to know. Well,
That was the other problem too, as you know, Goldie, you know, and I know, and I, you know, Alec, you know too, like multicams are the most fun shows to make. Like there is nothing that feels like more show business than making a multicam, like a tape night.
It's great.
And they are just the hardest shows to connect with an audience on TV, unless it's on CBS. I feel like it's very hard to really, even though like the most popular shows on streaming are multicams, it just still feels hard to really get it going.
Well, two things about this. The first is that it's like crypto, in that the timing of a multicam, when you do it, it's always the wrong time when you decide to jump in and make a multicam. Right. And then the second you decide, okay, I'm not doing a multicam, then it's the right time to do a multicam. And then it's like you saying, oh, NBC wants multicams now. It was like, well,
no, I could have helped you
2 years ago, you know?
Yeah, I had a multicam, was canceled. Then I had a meeting with the network like 6 months later about, what do you want to do next? And they said, we're looking for family multicams. I was like, I just had it. That's what I had.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the will not now syndrome. But so speaking of that, and you referred to this earlier, you did create a multicam about your life.
Yes.
Which I believe starred Fran Drescher. Is that correct?
Fran Drescher, Stephen Weber, Adam Pally.
It's a great cast.
Oh, there's a
it's a great cast. Yeah. And so now I would imagine that, you know, when you're on Whitney and Mulaney, it's one thing, because, you know, watching someone else's dream die can be kind of fun. But when you're doing, you're making your own show about your life, and then how did you feel about that? Because that's what happened to me with Dad's. Like, that was about my dad. And then America said, no, thank you. So how did you handle that? Were you instantly on to the next? I mean, or how did it go for you?
No, for me, well, it was, I loved making the show. I loved sort of, you know, like whenever you're on a staff, you're just like, I just want to be in charge. You know, let me just be in charge, you know? Right. And yes. And then you're in charge and you're like, fuck, could someone else be in charge?
Yes.
But because you realize, this is, I don't know about you guys, but what you realize when you have your own show is that you can't help but resent everyone, even your friends who are working on the show, because no one is thinking about it as much as you. And you're like, why aren't you guys also not sleeping? Like, I got frozen shoulder, which is something that only happens to to diabetic pregnant women. And that happened to me. That happened to me from stress, being so stressed out.
Goldie are so similar. This is unbelievable.
Well, we were both making like the same kind of show at the exact same time with the same studio.
With the same company.
Wow.
Yeah. So wow. He would text me from like...
well, Sony knows what they're doing, right? I mean, yeah, capable hands.
Sure. Everything's going to be fine. He's writing a suicide note.
At the end of my deal, I was like, can I just sell the televisions at Best Buy instead of doing TV? Like, I like the actual TV sets they make. I don't know about the stuff inside the TV, but I really believe strongly in the TV sets. If you want to just set me on the floor of Best Buy, I think I can move these.
I don't remember this, but I remember like we were both editing the shows and it was just like very stressful and I was like so stressed out and I called you and I was like, hey, are you editing? And you go, I'm in a pickup truck driving east.
Right. Yeah. Like the astronaut who was chasing down her lover across country with diapers on the whole time. You did. You had a porta potty in a bucket, right? In the back?
I did. I told that story on the podcast. Yeah. And that was for emergencies. And then within 70 miles of leaving, I had used it.
You got to like Downey.
No, I literally had not. I literally had not crossed the state line going like, and this is just, you know, in case because of COVID, like there's no good bathroom and whatever. And like, but I just need to know psychologically I have it so I never have to use it. And then it's just like within an hour, I'm like, I got to shit in the pocket.
I would say I was very upset. But what was weird about, you know, my show was it debuted with COVID. And it actually came out like the week of COVID. Oh. And we had an episode where Adam Pally gets sick. And sort of the idea where like every time like the dad is sick, like that's all that he takes over the entire family. Like no one's as sick as me. Like I just can't deal. Yeah. And they were like it was our most expensive episode because we built a pool because he was trying to like take his daughter to like swim class and he was sick and he didn't want to. And then he faints in the pool. It was funny. And and they were like, we're not airing that episode because everyone is dying in America.
Right.
I'm like, oh my God.
That is bad timing.
The show came out and there was this weird moment where like, because everyone was home, people started watching the show and there was like some hilarious headline that was like, indebted to coronavirus.
No.
and then we're like, okay, maybe the virus will help us. And then it seemed actually like we were going to get picked up and we did the whole thing. We pitched out season two and they were like, all right, this sounds good. And it felt like it was happening. And I was like, all right, this is gonna be great. And then we got a phone call that was like, everyone at Comcast was fired and replaced. So now everything's canceled. I'm like, okay, well, at least it's the pandemic.
Correct.
And that was,
were you relieved or were you bummed or both or how did he feel?
No, I was bummed because I felt like I figured out towards the end of the season, like the best version of the show, you know? Yeah. So I was like, now I could sort of figure out like how to make it the best way we could do. Also, the cast was so good, you know, and I felt like everyone was just like kind of getting going.
I wanted to make this point earlier about multicams, besides it being like the crypto market, that no one in the corporate environment we're in, no one has the patience, which is really just 8 to 10 episodes, to let you get to what the show's going to be for the next 90, where they're going to actually make back their investment. And so no one, it's like if farmers ran a farm and you go, this year we're not planting, and you go, we're going to save money this year. And that's like true in a sense, like you won't have to buy seeds. You won't have to pay for labor. You won't have to pay for equipment, whatever. But then there's not going to be a crop and you're not running a farm anymore.
Right. Yeah.
You're just not doing something. And I feel like the networks have become that. Like they're like, we're only going to do 6. And it's like, we're saving money and we're not. And it's right. But no trees will grow.
Right.
You're not a network because you're not airing things like a second season of anything.
You can't syndicate a show with 6 episodes every other year, you know?
Here come the deals. So you had also like a big chip in the game because Fran Drescher is like a sitcom commodity. When you get somebody like that on your show, it's going to help with everyone. So what was it like working with Fran Drescher? Because she's a sitcom legend.
Oh yeah, she was great. She brought chopped liver to the table read. So.
Did she?
Gross. Swear to God, yes.
I love chopped liver.
I love chopped liver too.
The smell.
After like a 9 a.m. table read, people were just like in like the soundstage, just like eating crackers and chopped liver. It was great. God,
it's like a melted work boot.
It actually was like amazing watching like her and Steven Weber. They've been on like hundreds and hundreds of episodes, so they're just like so good. You know, and it was fun. I mean, it was every show she's been in, she's played Fran has been sort of like her thing. So this time she was playing like a version of my mom. So that was sort of like the challenge was sort of like, you know, this character is a little bit different than some of the other characters you played. And she was like, I don't know. And I was like, no, it's different. It's different. You know, that had its challenges too, because, you know, she's so used to being in charge, you know, so there was like certain times where there was a story, you know, that she felt like was like a little too mean for her character. But I was would have to explain, well, that's just sort of like how my mom is. Like, this character is obsessed with her son. It doesn't matter. And she's going to do a monologue about her friend whose daughter can't get pregnant. And doesn't matter. That doesn't make sense. Because that's how my mom talks.
Right.
You know,
based on facts.
Let me ask you a question about this. So, because you look so young that it must be hard for you to give notes to actors, because they are like, why is this child telling me about my job?
Yes.
You know, like, and so I wonder, like, I have difficulty handling this, which is, you know, you're talking to a performer who, you know, maybe has a lot more experience than you. And sometimes I lean on the director where I kind of like whisper to them, like, hey, and they know too. But how did you handle that? Because you were working with such esteemed actors that, How did you handle when they weren't doing what you felt was the right thing?
I mean, I feel like when I would, you know, I was such a fan of them, like genuinely, that I think like that helps, you know, when you like who you're working with and they get that sense. Cause I feel like celebrities in general love compliments, you know?
Oh,
so like
yes,
if they enter a situation where they already know that they're so excited for you and they're rooting for you, that I feel like, you know, we had a good thing from the beginning, and it was hard. You know, sometimes it was just like a delicate conversation. Sometimes she was just like not going to do it because that's not the jokes that she's ever done, you know?
Yeah.
So it was just a little bit, you know, be back and forth. But I would just kind of be direct always, because I felt like, at least on like multicam sets, the directors are just really just a mouthpiece for the showrunner at all times. So they know when the information, who the information is coming from. So it was easier for me to get in there and be like, could you just say this exact thing just once? Yeah.
It is weird though, because when I first was on the set of my multicam, because we had such a respected director in Mark Sandrowski who did like Big Bang Theory and whatever, that I, you know, part of me, I was leaning on him a lot too. But I felt people were kind of waiting for him to say stuff. And Alec and I had worked with him before. And so I was very comfortable saying to him, hey, would you mind going out there and just, you know, and then I became a little more comfortable doing it myself. But I always just feel like people see a bald guy sort of like hunched over and walking toward them. And they're like, oh, Jesus Christ, like, what does he want?
Holding a bucket.
This is from my truck. This bucket from my truck.
This is for emergencies only, and it's always an emergency.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up, because you're so right that, like, you are legitimately, like, you're a fan of Steven Weber. He's hilarious. You're a fan of Fran Drescher because she's hilarious and delivered thousands of laughs to, you know, so many people over the years. And that's, you know, the way I felt on Dad's, like, you know, I Martin Mull is hilarious. Yeah. You know, Giovanni Ribisi is supremely talented. You know, Peter Riegert is a human being. So these are all the things.
I just wanted to do that line. That's it. That's all I wanted. Now, Goldie, I want to sidetrack for a minute with you, because we had a thing where after every Dad's show, we would have like a mini cast party, and it would be like at the Intercontinental Hotel right by the Fox lot, or like a bar, you know, kind of right nearby. And so we would all go, and the cast would go, and Goldie started noticing something about Peter Riegert. Will you tell us that, Goldie?
Well, it wasn't about him. It was he had like an entourage with him of just characters, like, and they seemed to rotate all the time. And he would just have these friends that were probably, in retrospect, New York theater friends. But then, you know, I would start giving them names like, oh, Peter's with his friend, a postman made entirely of hay.
You know? Right. Well, because his friends looked so weirdly different. Like, he would have one who was like 17 and one who was like 81 and one who was like a very large black man. You know, it would just be so out of place, and Goldie starts pointing out, like, Peter Riegert's coming with a mop and bucket.
A chimney sweep holding three trumpets on his right arm. You know, it's just like, who are these people? Well,
Fran Drescher also had a little bit of an entourage. She would have, like, her friend who was in charge of, like, her foundation with her at all times, like, her ex-gay husband, that's what she called him, Peter, who she created the nanny with. He was always there. And then, like, her hairstylist, who was always in, like, a full military outfit and just, like, running around the set. And was like, is this guy from a different soundstage? Like, where's he coming from?
But did you feel with them, I wonder, you know, they were, both Steven Weber and Fran Drescher were huge during the glory days of it all.
Oh, yeah.
And was there any shock that you noticed on their part where they were like, oh, my God, this has become not as important as it was? The state of things, were they ever shocked by it? Or were they, like, just happy to be there?
I think they were happy to be there. I think they're sort of, like, used to, like, a way of life that they had back when they were making, like, 600 episodes of Wings or whatever it was. Yeah. And they would talk about sort of, like, the glory days. But I think at least when we were making the show, again, as kind of was saying, we were in this bubble where, like, NBC was super supportive of the show. Like, all the executives, like, it was a great experience from that standpoint. And they just seemed very into it. And even, like, with the marketing and everything that started, it felt like we were kind of, like, in a good place, and they felt the support. So they were excited to kind of be, especially Steven, to be back on NBC doing a multicam on Thursday night. It felt like it was going to be a game changer, and it was not.
Yeah. And by the way, he loved you, because I remember we were both at Upfronts in New York the same time, which is when the networks sort of show all their new shows for the year. And I got flown out there, and then ABC did not show my show in the presentation. And then
I remember that.
That was my first indication that maybe this was not going to go great. But I talked to Steven Weber kind of at length at one of those parties, and he had very nice things to say about you. And he was very happy to be there.
Oh, that's awesome. So he's so funny, and he was so great. He was someone super who was nice, just like so too. Down to like do whatever. And
he's insane. He's insane, but in a good way. Like
in a great
way.
He's
like a crazy person who's very funny.
Yeah, I remember we had one episode just about how like you don't talk to your neighbors ever. You know, like especially like you just don't do it. But when your parents come, they just like befriend random people on your street. And there's like an episode where like he becomes such good friends with the neighbors that he's like going to like a Duke basketball game. He walks into the house, his face is painted blue and white. I mean, it's completely insane. But he was just like so down for any of that.
Not only does my mom do that, but then she asks about that person till the rest of time and cares more than what's happening with me.
Exactly.
How's your neighbor?
Like, oh, that man David I met, is he still, you know, and it's like, well, like, I do stuff.
Yeah. It's like, mom, also, David is a squatter and we think he kidnapped like five dogs on the street.
so this leads us into, because ostensibly we're a writer's podcast here with advice and all that kind of bullshit. Yes.
Unfortunately.
I know. Unfortunately, we have to get to that stuff. So, but you are someone who is known to me, known to Goldie, known to many in the business as someone who's great at pitching. And pitching is a big part of what we do. And I wondered if, because you've pitched many times successfully, have you noticed anything over the years about what helps make a successful pitch?
Yes, I feel like I always like to start my pitch off with some sort of personal antidote that is full of jokes that relates to whatever the TV show is. It could have nothing to do with it, but it could be just a funny story about like the characters who I'm developing the show about, or like whether it's my family or whatever, or like with the Kevin Hart show, I talked about, you know, just meeting Kevin Hart when I was 18 years old, the comic strip, and our first conversation was about sneakers, you know, and just sort of like going into that sort of story to kind of get people into the idea that I know what I'm going to talk about, or at least I have some sort of like, you know, very personal way in. And and I feel like that's sort of the best way to get them. And then I sort of just kind of – I have a format that I follow where it's like a really funny story into sort of, you know, the themes of the show into like a log line. And then I just kind of go really detailed into characters. And for me, sort of like everything is always about like the comedy, you know, and just like how funny can I make the pitch and how could I really like get the people. And for me, that's always sort of what it's been. And then kind of go through all of the characters – And then I have some like sort of like, you know, big wrap up about, you know, how the show's going to be very successful and we're all going to get very wealthy and it's going to be syndicated, blah, blah, blah. And then that's kind of like how I sort of go through. And then I'll, you know, I'll always have like five episode ideas, but I'll always pitch out the pilot. And then I'll say like, I have episode ideas if you want to hear any. And sometimes they'll say, yeah. And sometimes I say, no.
How far do you go in the pilot? Like, do you go just the sort of theme and the act breaks, or do you really get granular and say and go scene?
No, I'll do themes and act breaks, and then just depends, because now I don't know if you guys are dealing with this, but a lot of times now there's these pods and producers who really will like grind you in the pitch process, so you end up having almost like a story area before you even pitch your first pitch, and that could be honestly sometimes frustrating, because I feel like a lot of times whatever you're pitching in the room during the pitch for the pilot, that's never what the pilot's going to be, unless it's a true premise pilot, like it's just not going to be what it is. But that's sort of my format that I kind of go, and I always feel like it's normally around like 7 to 8 pages, and they're around 20 minutes.
Well, you're also really good at assembling talent and attracting talent and attracting producers. So I was actually hoping you could talk a little bit. I know some of these you have relationships dating back to stand-up or whatever, but you also seem very good at like, here's a big producer, here's a piece of talent, here's me connecting them with the idea, and now we're going in to pitch. And I just wondered if you have an approach prior, do you have an idea and then try to get the pieces, or do you think of the pieces and then try to come up with the idea?
Yeah, I mean, I always come with the idea first, and then I try to put the pieces together, because I just feel like, especially now, like I feel like if you talk to anyone, they're always going to say like, oh, it's such a hard time to sell right now. But I feel like it's not if you have the right package, you know, because people are always excited about, you know, people coming in together and exciting people and powerful producers and all that kind of stuff. So I feel like that's something that I always try to do. And just from like doing this for 20 years now or whatever, I just like feel like I know, you know, enough people and talented people that I really like. And I just know that, you know, I could get to them, and with the right people, just kind of putting it together and going into the place.
That's I love your specific advice about how long, you know, pages and minutes pitches should be, because I feel like nothing is worse for someone pitching when you pitch too long. Like that's just death instantly. Now, something you have that I will speak for Goldie, neither he or I have, is a sunny disposition. Do you feel like, okay, I really need to Dan Levy it up in here today? Like, I need to be like this happy person? Or are you just like genuinely like happy and excited about the stuff you're doing? Or do you put it on?
You mean in general, or like
I'm saying, like in a pitch meeting, are you like, okay,
I have to punch myself in the bathroom in the face before to get up for it.
Yeah.
What do you do?
when I'm pitching, I feel like I always sort of like step it up. Like I treat pitches like a performance, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Sounds like it.
And especially on Zoom now, I feel like you're able to almost use your pitch pages like a teleprompter, you know? So I feel like even more so, I'm trying to like, you know, get people excited, because I feel like it's just harder to like get that energy on Zoom. Like I miss being in person, because I just feel like it's better, and you could like reference the people in the room and make fun of your studio executive, whatever you need to do to sort of liven it up. but most part, most of the time I feel like I'm how I am. In a writer's room, I'm like, you know, always, you know, I just like to be around like funny people, you know? So I feel like I'm going to be in a good mood if I'm around funny people. Like I've been on shows where like people aren't funny, and then you're like, well, this side, it's got to like really like, should I start juggling? Like how can I electrify this room? Because it feels insane, you know? Yeah. Like there's nothing worse for me than being in a room that's supposed to be a comedy room and people are just like, I have a problem with the character. And I'm like, I'm going to actually blow my brains out on the Zoom just so there's a good story.
Yeah. Right.
Did you, coming from stand-up, want to be a writer, or did you want to be doing stand-up and be on the show? Or were you agnostic toward it?
In the beginning, that's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to, you know, do stand-up and like have a sitcom. That was always sort of like my goal when I was like younger. And then as I, you know, got just more into wanting to do things and developing things, I just realized that like writing was going to be like the best way to do it. So it all started with, if you guys remember Crackle, not to name drop, but Crackle.com, I had this series called Long Distance Relationship about being in a long distance relationship in college. And I wrote that with Tal Rabinowitz as my executive.
Oh,
and,
nice.
And then she sort of helped me. We then pitched it to MTV. It was like a web series that became a pilot. And that was the first time I wrote like a real pilot. And we did it for MTV and we shot it. And then it didn't get picked up. But the people at Sony at the time were like, but you should do something else. And then I went and then I hooked up with the late, great Jamie Tarsus. And then I pitched an NBC show with her. And that was the first sitcom that I sold. And I wrote like a pilot. And that was how I kind of got in. At the same time, Whitney Cummings had her sitcom. And we were kind of writing pilots at the same time. And she was like, hey, if one of my shows gets picked up, do you want to work on it? And I was like, yeah, maybe, let me know. And then both her shows got picked up.
Oh, that's awesome. Uh-huh.
And then I worked on Whitney. And that was the first time I entered like a sitcom room where I was like, oh, look at all these funny people. I didn't even know. In my mind, you know, starting comedy like in New York and in Boston, it was like, if you want to write on sitcoms, you have to be like at the Harvard Lampoon. You know, that was just always in my mind for whatever reason.
Right.
So when I got into the room, I was like, oh, these guys are so funny. That room was just like insanely funny. You know,
this
Sam
Sclaver. This is the Whitney room.
The Whitney room. Sam Sclaver, Matt Horowitz, you know, Danielle Sanchez. I mean, there was some like just hilarious people in that room. John Quaintance, like
Matt Horowitz.
Matt Horowitz.
Matty H.
Just killer. So that was just, it was just so fun. And I was like, wow, all these people are so funny. And I was not even aware of it. And then I started like noticing that they all drove like really nice cars. And I was like, what is happening?
It's so funny that you mentioned Matt Horowitz, because I knew Matt Horowitz when he was just starting in the business and he was Craig Kilborn's assistant.
Right.
On the Late Late Show. And I remember a very funny thing where Craig didn't want Maddie around when Maddie was eating lunch. He didn't like the way he ate. So I always used to give Horowitz shit about that. I'm like, oh, I can hear you chewing, Maddie. Better run down the hallway. He's such a nice guy, though, and really funny. So I'm
really
glad to hear he succeeded there. Now, you mentioned Tal. So I wanted to say, she sent in a question.
Okay.
She said, she says hello, by the way.
Hello.
She said, must have been nice to leave your wife with three fucking kids while you went on the road. And I wrote, that's not really a question, but I'll go ahead and say it for you anyway. So now just let's talk a little bit about this tour with Mulaney, because I saw, you know, on your Instagram posts from a lot of the stadiums, literally, where you guys were playing. So what is it like to do stand-up in front of thousands of people? I think Goldie and my record is 12 people. So I'm very interested to hear what that was like for you.
Well, it's been an amazing and insane and overwhelming experience, because as we discussed, I have been really mostly in writer's rooms for like at least a decade now, you know, so I haven't been out and about performing like I did in my 20s and, you know, early 30s. So it sort of happened where he came out of rehab in his situation. He's like, I'm going on a tour. You should come and do a spot. And I was like, okay. So I looked at where he's performing and I was like, I'll go to Omaha. You know, that seems like a good place to kind of get my feet wet. And because I was like doing spots here and there, you know, in LA, as soon as sort of like things started kind of coming back to life, you know, just at these outdoor shows to see people. So I went to Omaha with him and it was awesome. It was 14,000 people. It was crazy.
That's awesome.
Oh, and it was so fun. And then he's like, come and do these other shows. Come to Minnesota and come to Berkeley. And I was like, great. And then we did two shows in Berkeley. And I was like, that's awesome. It's been so fun. And then I got a bunch of people tickets to see him at the Hollywood Bowl because everyone wanted to see the show. And then we get back to LA and he's like, you should come to the Forum tonight. And I was like, tonight? I was like, I'm in the Valley. It's going to take so long to get there. But then I went to the Forum and then I performed the Hollywood Bowl.
Wow.
And ever since then, I've been on all the dates. So it's been awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, I got goosebumps just thinking about it.
What is your approach? I mean, because you're opening. So opening, you know, on a stadium, I guess the burden is less like it is in a club to sort of go in the crowd and get them warmed up. But I mean, you still do have that burden of like letting everyone know, hey, this is a show. You have to be kind of quiet and listen, but also be kind of loud and laugh. And like, how do you even wrap your mind around what you're doing up there?
Yeah, I mean, well, this comic Seton Smith, who's super funny, he's the host. So he comes out and he really gets the show going. So then, but then I come out when they're just like ready to see John at that point.
Yeah. And even squinting, they must be like, there he is. Like, they didn't quite hear your intro. They're like, oh, he has glasses now.
He looks different. What did cocaine do to his face? It made him Jewish.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs,
a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And then, and then you come out and it kind of actually feels like every show feels like a giant production. You know, there's three production trucks that follow us around. They build the stage each time. There's cameras. So you're really sort of like, kind of like almost doing like a TV set, you know, every time you're performing, because you kind of like got to talk to the cameras because you can't really see that many people because it's just these giant arenas. But I've just been, you know, really just like putting together my act like I would, you know, in the past, you know, and when I'm in town now, I'm performing a lot around LA and just like, you know, working on it and coming up with it. I mean, he is just so good that I'm just constantly trying to like elevate my stand-up.
You but know? Not be too good, because, I mean, that's what, like, that's the trick of being the person who's not the headliner. If you go, I want to do really well and help the show, but if you go, I don't want people leaving going like, that guy, though, was better. then you're in a different kind of trouble, you know?
It's been, I don't think I've run into that problem yet, but... I was always
conscious of that.
when you were opening for Gaffigan.
The story I always tell is, so I, you know, my whole goal my whole life was to be on a late night show. And, you know, I did Kilborn, that was great. And then I did Kimmel, which was, you know, the earlier spot, the midnight or 11:30. And that, you know, I built this up in my mind that I'm going to get on a late night show and then, you know, the executives will see me and then they'll say, you develop a show for you. There was going to be this entry point for the rest of my life. So I do this set on Kimmel. It goes fine. Like it's not incredible. It's not terrible. It's good. It's fine. And then as the crowd is leaving, they don't even recognize me as the person who was on stage. And at that moment, I thought to myself, I might not have this it quality that you need to succeed as the center of something. Because the people who just saw me don't know that was me. And that happened again in the screening of Ted 2. Yeah. I couldn't get recognized in the theater where I had two scenes in the movie.
Well, it's so funny because, you know, I wear like a suit, you know, when I'm doing these shows, and I'm, you know, these arenas are huge. So after one show in, I think it was in Delaware, I was like, I want to go to the top, you know. In the summer, we do these big like amphitheaters. So I was like, I want to go all the way to the lawn and just like see what it looks like. Yeah. So I took my suit off and I went up there and like security came over me and they're like, because I was taking a picture, like, you have a phone, you can't be here. They like, bring three securities over. I was like, I was on stage. They're like, no, you weren't. I was like, no, I was. And I'm like trying to prove that I am.
Oh my goodness.
Well, your clothing with you is a huge thing.
I love clothes.
Right. Oh. So in these pictures, like, you have 100 suits. I mean, you must be spending a fortune. B, do you have a stylist? Are you doing this all yourself? Like, talk about your relationship with these clothes and sort of like you have three kids and you're spending all this money on clothing. So what's going on?
Well, I'm what people refer to, like my wife, as irresponsible. I really like, I've always liked clothes. Like your friend Adam Pally, we share a love for Johns, as we call them. And it's just sort of fun to be performing, you know, and I feel like it's in a performance like this big, you have to sort of dress up. John always wears suits too. So that's sort of why I sort of embrace like the different looks for the shows.
And do you own that stuff, or is a wardrobe person bringing it and then taking it away?
No, I own it. And then there's been some people who've like made stuff for me to wear, you know, but I don't have a stylist. I just sort of have like my own sort of intuition when it comes to great clothes, like the sweater that you made fun of.
Yeah, I did. Right away.
Right away.
Right away.
So who has the big closet in your bedroom, you or your wife?
I do.
Yeah, that's the same at my house too.
Oh, really? She doesn't. Yeah.
This has got to be part of the sneaker pitch.
Totally.
Who has the bigger closet? Because that would in my house cause a problem.
Yeah, no, my wife is the opposite. Like, she wants nothing. There are these buy nothing groups that I think your wife is on.
My wife is
obsessed with buy nothing, which is basically you just give stuff to people. Huh. And every day there is just bins and bins of stuff she's giving away. Our neighbors thought we were running a food co-op because people come to our house so much to get her garbage.
My kids were she's given away so much of their stuff, my kids almost staged like a pitchfork style revolt. They're like, what is that? Something's on the steps. They're like, we want that.
We want it. We don't know what it is, but we want it.
I know. She pulls in so much garbage off the street, too. It's like my living room's like a hospice for Salvation Army.
I think it's nice you like clothes. You know, every girl's crazy about a sharp dressed Dan.
You've been holding on to that one.
All the puns in.
Oh, ZZ Bottom.
Over the top. All right, well, now we've kept you here for a long time, and we know time. We were all over that.
Guys, but I just want to get. Nothing to do today.
I want to get back to something about pitching because I'll never forget when I had our famous lunch.
Yes.
You, me, and Steve Bazalone, you guys told me about an interesting pitch meeting you had with Eddie Murphy. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. Yeah, so me and Steve had the privilege of rewriting the script of Triplets, which was a sequel to Twins.
Okay.
Now, to get that movie greenlit for us to get paid, we need to have Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito, and Eddie Murphy agree on the story. So the executives at the time, Ali Bell and the late, great Ivan Reitman, brought us to Arnold Schwarzenegger's house, and we pitched Arnold Schwarzenegger the movie. And they told us it's going to be super casual, like just casually just talking about the idea. Arnold's like so in. And we get there. There's nothing casual about Arnold Schwarzenegger. We sit down for like a 3-course lunch. There's like all these like chefs like bring us all this chicken. And I'll never forget like this giant blueberry pie that he just kept like shoveling in his mouth. He's like, that's very good. I hear you're so funny. He kept saying that. He's like, I hear so much about you. I was like, there's no way you hear about me. There's no way.
It's all over town.
It's all over town. It's crazy. I can't go anywhere, and I have the pitch like in my pocket because I thought it wasn't me casual. I would like look down, but I could not take like papers out over his like blueberry pie. So so we just kind of like start going into it, and like as Steve is talking about like this moment of like Danny DeVito's wife dies, and it makes him really want to reconnect with his brother. Arnold Schwarzenegger's fucking horse named Whiskey walks into the kitchen, gallops into the kitchen, and starts eating food off of Arnold's plate.
Whiskey, no!
He's like, Whiskey, what are you doing? And we're like, what the fuck? And we're trying to act cool. And he's like acting normal, and he's like feeding the horse and looking at us. He's like, and then act two? And we're like, what the fuck? And then we have this whole ridiculous pitch meeting. Before we leave, he grabs my bicep, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the greatest moment of my life. He grabs my bicep, and he goes, I'm proud of you. I go, all right, Steve is so mad. Steve has been through a lot in his life. There is nothing worse than he felt than when Arnold grabbed my arm and complimented me over him. And then
he's going to grab Steve's arm with the OK symbol. Look at that. I shouldn't be able to do this around your bicep.
And then as we're leaving, it was like we were just like sweating, like, what was that? And then Ivan Reitman like looks at me and Steve and he goes, pretty interesting guy, right? Yes. So then they were like, Arnold's in. We're like, great, but you guys need to get Danny DeVito. So we go and we meet with Danny DeVito. He had a long sort of goatee at the time, and we're sitting in this restaurant in Santa Monica, and we pitch him the whole thing. The first thing he says to us, he goes, so I have a real question for you guys. And we're like, why? And he's like, why do you want to do this? We're like, I don't know, money. We want money. And then, so we pitch the whole thing. It's also like a 35-minute pitch. And we wrap the whole thing up. We look at him, and he's like, I remember he went like with his goatee. He's like, can you go through that first part again?
Oh,
and,
no.
And Steve goes, wait, what part? And he goes, you know what? Pitch me the whole thing again. And we're like, are you fucking kidding me? So we're like, oh, we've always liked the movie Twins. And he's like, no. But then they were like, Danny is in. So we're like, great. So then they're like, you just got to go to Eddie Murphy's house. And we're like, hell yeah. This is going to be the greatest thing ever. I'm so excited. I love Eddie Murphy. Plus, Eddie Murphy, I heard, always talk, like whenever he talks to Chris Rock, I heard them say this on Marc Maron, whenever he talks to Chris Rock, Eddie Murphy only wants to talk about stand-up from the 80s and the comics from the comic strip and like where they are now. That's all he wants to talk about. So I was like, I just got to like talk about the comic strip and I'll get in with Eddie Murphy. So we get to his house, the biggest house ever, behind like 17 gates. Like one of those like crazy areas where there's like armed guards. Like it was just like, you're like, this is, are we in LA? It's insane. And we get there and we like walk in and it's just this like big house. And we're like waiting for him, like in the entryway. And then we just hear like, you motherfuckers here? Like, oh my God. This is like the greatest thing ever. And we go into his room and with like 100-foot ceilings. And there's just like amazing, you know, frame stuff everywhere. His Mark Twain Award, just posters. It was just like, you know, you were in his office.
Yeah.
And he's watching, you know, he has movie trivia on, like, just playing on his TV. And he tells us he's obsessed with movie trivia. And he does it all night long. And we're like, okay. And then... And then we're like, we're waiting for Arnold to show up because Arnold's late. It's raining in LA. So it rains in LA. It's hard.
He's
to
on
places.
Horseback too.
Yeah, he's on horseback.
Risky.
So then we're just like waiting. And then I just like, I got to say something. And I was like, Eddie, I'm a comedian. I started the comic strip. And he's like, comedian? And then we just started talking and he was just, and he kind of went into it. He started talking about like stand up and how he wants to get back into it. And was like, it was just this like really awesome moment. And then Arnold Schwarzenegger comes like rushing in, soaking wet in a brown leather jacket, sits down. He's like, I'm sorry. It's just Donald Trump's tweeting at me all day. The guy's obsessed.
Oh my God. That's hilarious.
And me and Steve are like, we are sitting in Eddie Murphy's house and Arnold Schwarzenegger is complaining about Donald Trump, who's obsessed with him, who is also the president.
Oh, there's that. Weird.
Oh, we're like, this needs to be the movie. So then we wrote the movie and then we finished the movie. And we thought it was gonna happen. We were in this conference room. We wrote it, and we were with like the financiers, and they were just like ready to make it because it's Arnold Schwarzenegger. They could just sell it like immediately.
Yeah.
And then Ivan Reitman, RIP, looks at the financier, and he's like, "You know what?" The guy's like, "Yeah, so we could start, you know, pretty soon." And Ivan Reitman's like, "You know what? I feel like it's not ready." And we're like, "What? What do you mean it's not ready?" He's like, "Yeah, it's just not ready yet." And we're like, "We're it's ready to go." And then it died. And then they ended up like having new people come in to write the movie.
Oh, no.
And then that movie was about to get made. But then Ivan Reitman died. So now I don't know what's happening. So now I think it's just sort of in the universe, both scripts. Wow. So RIP to my script and Ivan Reitman.
Yeah.
And God
bless
everyone.
What an amazing, amazing pitch story.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And now before we let you go, I just want, anything you want to say about your Kevin Hart project? What's going on with that? When can we look forward to that?
Well, I hope we could look forward to it soon. I'm not sure. It's the draft is now in, so I'm sort of waiting on those like initial notes.
Who are you working with? What studio?
I'm working with Sony.
Okay. Oh boy.
I'm working with Sony Studios.
Yeah.
And I'm working with Sony, and we're doing it for Peacock. So it's all the same executives from my sitcom. So I'm excited to like get in with them and start working again. So I'm just like waiting to find out. But
good. Yeah. It's, awesome.
So yeah. It could be, as Goldie might say, streaming on the cock.
It could be streaming on the cock.
I love that. Well, Dan Levy. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Amazing.
You made us smile, which is hard to do. I don't think I've ever seen Goldie ask so many questions. So he was clearly engaged today.
I love you guys, you know how much I love you guys, and I love this podcast. So I was honored to be a part of it. So thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Dan Levy, everyone.
Yay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh God. Dan is so funny.
That Arnold story.
It was
hilarious.
I
wish that happened to me.
I know, me too.
You would never stop talking about it. Whiskey now.
Whiskey.
Down, whiskey. That was hilarious. And Dan Levy has an infectious laugh.
Yeah.
And he's a great guy.
And I kind of can't stand him because he's so fucking nice and positive, and I just don't get it. Like, yeah. Give him 80% of that and me 20, and then watch what I do. What would I do? I don't know.
You know, just be slightly more pleasant as you chat in front of your friends.
On FaceTime in front of my friends.
Why do we need FaceTime anymore? But the pandemic is over. Just start shitting in front of your friends.
Just come on into the bathroom with me.
The porta potties in the truck.
Welcome to my bathroom with Alex Salkin.
We built this shitty. All right. Now let's get into a portion of the show that we like to call Top 5.
Top 5.
Soothing tones of us singing. Goldie, this was your list today. Tell the folks what we're going to be top 5-ing about.
So this is the top 5 menu items you can order at an Italian restaurant. As I said last week, these are primi, secondi, dolce, antipasti, any part of the menu. But when you go to an Italian restaurant, what's your agenda? Mm-hmm. What do you do? So here is mine.
Okay.
Yes.
Number 5.
Yeah.
If they have it, I want to know how they're doing their pizza.
Oh, nice.
Sure.
Got to know. Yes. This is how I'm judging it. Because my whole framework for doing this, by the way, is how I'm going to judge the restaurant. I'm going to evaluate it in this imaginary review in my head.
Yeah. Pizza's important.
Yeah, yes. Pizza. So it's Pizzy. Like, can you knock out pizza? These are the figure skating jumps, the single lutz.
Yeah.
It's sort of like the boring dancing stuff. It's like, show me your pizza.
Pizzy.
Number 4 is I'm going to order whatever is the antipasto. I want to see, you know, what spread of cheeses and meats do you bring me? Because that tells me the quality of your ingredients.
Yeah. Nice, yes.
Because it's a deconstructed whatever.
All right, okay. So you for that one, agenda. So 4 is cheese and meats?
Yeah, the antipasta, because it also tells you what kind of olive oil they're using, what kind of vinegar, and if they put care into their bread, all this stuff's important. So here we get now to the heart of my evaluation. Number 3, cioppino, the fish stew.
Ooh.
How fresh is your seafood?
Yes.
How crusty is your bread? How spicy is your tomatoes?
You're turning into Kilborn. I love it.
Number 2.
Yeah.
And this is where it just, we really get into it. Bring me your meatball.
Ooh.
Bring it to me.
Nice.
Now I'm going to go Gordon Ramsay on this thing.
That is a good one.
I'm either going to
nod satisfied or I'm going to drag you into the kitchen and yell at you about your dad. And number 1, because it's my favorite dish, I could eat it every meal the rest of my life, and it just tells me it is your signature of your restaurant, chicken parm.
That's a good one.
No pastas.
Debated it.
That's true.
I know. We had very different lists.
I don't like pasta.
JC, do you want to go or should I go?
Yeah, I'll go.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm literally shifting stuff around because I'm taking a huge shift right now, but not on FaceTime. Okay. So my number 5
Fart time.
There we go.
My number 5, it's the last thing you would order, possibly, but I would say the tiramisu.
Susan.
Yeah, I'm catching on slowly. Yeah. I would say it's a judge of whether, if it's authentic, if they're taking a twist on it. It really, really says a lot about, you know, the closer.
When I was in college in New York with my buddy, like, we used to have this whole routine about how everyone always in the 90s acted as though they had just discovered tiramisu.
I know, that's true.
And that they were then obligated, like an Amway salesman, to sell you on the concept of tiramisu. Like, have you tried tiramisu? Have you had the tiramisu?
Yeah, it's just like,
I never liked it that much, but so we would go out to dinner all the time in college and say, like, you've got to try the tiramisu. And then, you know, one of us would go, well, I'm not really in the mood. Well, I don't care if you're in the mood.
You have to try the tiramisu.
Like, we had this whole elongated. It's like we had no friends. We had no friends when we just did this.
Sexually
shout out
assault.
To John Voigtman.
Oh, Voigtman.
I love a tiramisu. I don't really like tiramisu, but one thing I have noticed about tiramisu is that you can inhale
the
powdered chocolate on top and start coughing, which has happened to me a couple of times.
Yeah.
Well, if I'm going to be honest, it's not my favorite thing, but it is a way for me to judge if it's good. Okay, number four, and this could have been number one for me, is the linguine alla vongole. That is, for me, if it is good, then I will come back to this restaurant. But if
you
not...
You like a white sauce or a red sauce?
I like a white sauce.
Oh, yes. Creamy. Yes.
Well, no, like more like olive oil and white wine.
Aglio.
Yes, that's what I meant. Sorry. Yes. Okay, my number three is the bruschetta. Is am I saying bruschetta. It right? Am I saying it right?
Bruschetta.
I'm not Italian, in case you didn't know.
Nothing's better than tomatoes falling off bread.
Number two is the prosciutto and melon.
That's good.
Oh, yes.
Just prosciutto.
That can go south real fast if the melon is at all off.
Yeah.
I don't like melon.
Melon has one good hour.
Yeah. That is so true. And then for me, number one is if they have a good burrata. Am I saying that right?
Sure.
Burrata. Yeah.
The
burrata.
Vomit of the cheese world.
Burrata. The what is it?
The vomit of the cheese world.
No. Well, that's involved in one of my picks.
How many journal entries are there about burrata?
You know, well, there's probably only two because you can't really get them at a cheese shop. Yeah. But like I came home and wrote about it.
Where was your best burrata?
Well,
she's going to have to look that up.
Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah. But it's in New York. I just don't remember.
New York burrata.
Is that a buffalo cheese burrata or is it a cow? Do you?
Oh, wow. Oh, no. I don't know, but I am very impressed that you even asked that question.
Yeah, I mean, the notebook lady should have those answers.
This is how I stay married. Amazing questions.
Yes.
All right. Are we ready?
We're ready.
Okay, my top five things at an Italian restaurant. Number five, and Goldie, I'm very surprised this wasn't on your list. It's basic. It's early. Garlic bread.
Oh, yeah.
It is good.
Yeah, and... Because you were talking about judging. Well, I like to judge bread. Thank you.
Yeah.
Bread. Number four, sort of mix prosciutto e burrata.
Oh.
I like it better than the melon. I'm with you, Goldie. If the melon is slightly off in one direction, it kind of ruins the whole thing. But I love the prosciutto. Number three, and my orders are very New England Italian, you'll see.
Okay.
Number three. Spaghetti carbonara.
Oh,
it's so heavy on a cold winter's day. I love the carbonara.
That
nice
should have been on my list, I gotta say.
And then number two and one are similar, but I'm doing it anyway. Number two, I always enjoy penne arrabbiata.
Oh.
Give it to
What's
me.
What's that?
That's spicy.
Okay.
The spicy one. It's got a little kick to it, Johnny. And number one... Number one, variations on a theme, I like the penne alla vodka.
Oh. Mm.
Enjoy that creamy deliciousness.
You're fucking drunk.
I get my buzz on with my penny. All right, that was a fun list. Fun list, yes. Top five.
So what's it going to be, Alex? Songs, you got to be in the
song. No. Yeah, it's songs because I know you don't like them, and now you've got me on that. So keep complaining about them because they'll keep coming. Oh,
songs when you're FaceTiming your friends as you take it
down. On the toilet. No, here it is for next week. This is top five Leave It All on the Field songs.
What does that mean?
That means this is where a performer has just left it all on the stage or in the sound booth. Like they've just gone nuts while singing and it's great.
Okay.
They've thrown all of themselves into this song and it's exciting to you.
Okay. I'm typing this so I don't forget.
That's what we're doing next week, Goldie.
Cool.
What do you think?
I'm excited.
What
I'm really
do you
excited.
Think?
I'm really excited.
Are you ready to sound the alarm? all right. I don't think we have any other business to do.
No.
Let's end the show, as we always do, on a high note.
I got one.
Go.
Go.
So we have a lemon tree. Ooh. And very sporadic. But my wife, it was not in good health. My wife tended it back to health. And then kind of like once every year and a half or so. Endless lemons. 50 beautiful lemons. And I love squeezing lemons
nice.
Onto things. So there's nothing better. It is the real California lifestyle when you walk into your backyard wow. and you have free fruit.
Yes, yes. Totally.
I am taking advantage right now, and it is one of my favorite things.
Oh, that's awesome. Awesome.
That's awesome. JC, go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, I'll go. Well, guess what? This one's about Stu, guys. He played two nights at the Hollywood Bowl with Danny Elfman, and they were epic nights. I went out two nights in a row.
Awesome.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was really amazing night, very special, and he was amazing.
That's great. Yes. Go Stu.
Go Stu.
All right. Well, my high note is about one of the other people on this podcast. So my high note this week is JC.
What?
JC. Hey, JC.
Yeah, I got goosebumps just thinking about it.
And I'll tell you why. JC put together that Starship song, and I don't think we all appreciate exactly what went into that. Because not only, all right, we're singing, and when I say we, I sang one part, and JC sang three harmony parts around it.
Yeah.
Wow. JC also added all of the instrumentation. She pumped up the drums. She did all this production on this thing, which I love and cannot stop listening to, and Goldie and our fans seem to not care at all about it.
I do care.
It's okay. Goldie cares. Yeah.
It was just all so much. When it was.
I know. It was overwhelming. Anyway, JC, you did a fantastic job on that.
It was great.
I love listening to it.
You.
It sounds terrific. So thank you for that. Thank you, Goldie and JC, for always being awesome. Thank you all for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
What? Fuck you.
That was fun.
And it stops right now.
You motherfuckers here?